Welcome to the White Hats and Lab Coats podcast, presented by the Biohacking Village. Each episode will explore DIY bio, citizen science, and medical device security with guests from the healthcare, cybersecurity research, and biohacking communities. Hosted by Nina Alley and Bo Woods.
Hello, welcome to White Hats and Lab Coats, the Biohacking Village podcast. Nina, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good.
See, that was a preemptive strike. I was trying to ask how you were.
Yeah.
Next time. I know. You're just too quick.
Yes.
So. Our guest today. Is Najla Lindsay. Yeah. So she does Defer, which I call it Defer. I didn't realize that wasn't known. So
I'm just behind the times.
Maybe. So digital forensics incident response.
Okay.
Right. I don't want to just call it DFIR. I mean, I get it, but Defer is so much cuter. And so, hey, girl, hey.
Hey, girl, hey.
Hey. So she sent me the best bio I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Okay. So 1 cup forensics, 1/4 cup of toxicology, 1 heaping tablespoon of InfoSec, 1 bottle of red wine with some crime shows. And here lies the most beautiful recipe for a white hat with a lab coat. Ooh, I'm not even mad at this.
I like it.
So what I'm thinking is now that you have this, you actually need to make a real recipe. Because we've been talking
I think so.
Because we've been talking about beer and rice wine all day and everybody's got recipes for things. So if you end up making this into a cake or like something, we are more than happy to be in on this food. So I want to talk about you. Are you ready? Because it's about to get real.
I'm ready.
All right.
Oh, man, I'm ready.
I know, because you know our normal conversation. So first of all, for the people in the audience, what's DFIR, affectionately known by me as Defer?
Well, Defer to you, but affectionately and lovingly known as Digital Forensics and Incident Response. Mm-hmm. That's a mouthful, right? You know, saying that in a sentence. So usually people just abbreviate it DFIR. But since you made it a cute Defer, you know, I actually might have to steal that and start using that going forward.
I'll trademark it later. So at the crux of it, what is it?
So at the crux of it, we're all digital now, right? Basically, everything is digital. You can't get away from it. They're digital incidents. And so when things happen, you have to kind of work backwards to figure out what has gone on. So electronics, everyone has them. There's no getting around it. If you don't have one, I'm not sure what world you're living in, but it's just not possible not to have it. And so we have it where things are getting taken. Things are, you know, data starts going missing. Things get lost. And so we use digital forensics to figure out what's going on.
So you're basically
work backwards.
You're CSI cyber in real life.
CSI cyber, yes, in real life. That's my inspiration, actually. Mm. CSI is my inspiration. So in real life, not as quick as like how CSI likes to make it. Like they just have the evidence, and then 5 minutes later,
boom, you fixed it.
Joe Schmo did it, and you're like, okay, yeah, he did. In real life, it takes time. If you catch an answer real quick, you caught a very lucky break. But it takes time. It takes tact. It takes technique. You have several different procedures that you have to follow. And very, very important in that community is a chain of custody, because that tells your story. You know, anything can happen on the way from collecting the evidence to analyze it in a lab setting. So that chain of custody, which everybody hates documentation for whatever reason, It's very, very important to digital forensics. And then you have your incident response. Not every security event is an incident. So you have to be mindful and make sure that what is happening is actually an incident. And then you enact your incident response plan. And surprisingly, a lot of businesses and corporations and things of that nature don't have them in place. Or if they do, they haven't been looked at in a couple of years. So
But you brought up...
We have those two lovely things.
So you brought up a lot of good points, and I've been taking notes. So let's talk about the documentation first. It's mindful storytelling at its core. Why do hackers, scientists, have so many issues with writing down the documentation? Because it would make going backwards so much easier, or going forward so much easier. What is the issue? How can DFIR help?
So a lot of there's a disconnect, right? So digital forensics is a part of the forensic science community, but not a lot of people realize that that is part of the forensic science community as well. So those trained in electronics or computer systems don't necessarily have the same processing for, you know, looking at solving problems like a scientist does. So when you're a scientist, you're in the lab, you're doing an experiment, right? So you've added one drop of sugar and then you've added a teaspoon of honey. You're observing the interactions and the reactions that happen. So that, you know, as you're doing that, you have to notice because there could be a quick color change. And if you miss it, mm-hmm. you've went past your reaction. So now you have to start over. So I as far as those that are more computer people, you know, they're in the thick of it. You know, they're, you know, they type a command or they run a program and it instantly happens. And so they've gotten to that next level of what they needed to get to, not thinking that, okay, if someone comes behind me, they need to be able to follow these steps as well. So I think that, you know, I think this may be a learned thing too in school. I'm not sure. I've never taken a computer class, but from my observation of what I've seen, you know, computer people are just, you know, they're going after their main target and they're not necessarily thinking about, okay, what's actually happening as you do step one, or what's actually happening as you do step two. They're not thinking about that reaction and that observation. So that way they'll know, okay, I did these five steps and it led me here. And to go back and see that those five steps led you here. So you don't have to do the experiment all over again. You know where you need to start. You know where you need to finish. But scientists, we're always documenting. Like we run labs. We in school, we have labs for hours. I'm talking 4-hour labs, like 2 and 3 days a week. Lab notebooks filled with equations and colors and metrics and everything. So I think that that's where there's a kind of a disconnect on the documentation.
So let's talk about the merge between the science and the technical science, the infosec science. What are the rigors of DFIR in medical devices? Because that's a whole different animal on its own.
Correct. I think it's very rigorous. I think that, you know, the individuals making the medical devices, you know, they have a goal that they're trying to meet, or they have something that they're trying to achieve with these medical devices to make the medical and the healthcare industry better. So I think that, you know, they're not thinking about the scientific aspect of it per se. They're focused on their main product, right? Because the medical device is a product for the company. So they're thinking about getting that product out. They're not taking into account what the scientific aspect of it will do. Or, you know, if something happens and someone randomly just decides to hack into the programming for that medical device, what the chain reaction will be for that. So I think that DFIR comes in where you kind of put that in place beforehand. So you're taking security and forensics and incident response into mind before you get to your final stages of your product, instead of after, and then you having to come back and do patches or completely take the product off the market because someone has found a way to make it behave not so good as it was intended to be.
So you're using a lot of sciencey language. Do you have a background as a scientist? Is that what your degree is in?
Yes, it's forensic science, actually.
Awesome. Tell us about that.
CSI, I mentioned, as we mentioned earlier, I used to love CSI Miami. Like Horatio one-liners.
Oh, so not my favorite CSI, thing in life. Not just CSI Cyber. All of the CSI universe is like...
Yes, the CSI universe. Yes. So I know... So as forensic scientists, we get trained in all areas of forensic science. So ballistics, trace evidence. We've gone and done crime scenes. Like they made mock crime scenes for us. And we had to go out. They'd give us a scenario. And we had to go out and collect the evidence, tell a story, document everything that we have done, pictures, all everything that you actually see on CSI, that is part of the learning process and what I've learned in school. Aside from getting quick results as they do, it is very consistent as far as the different aspects of the forensic science field.
So are they actually teaching digital forensics in forensic sciences classes, or is that still a little bit down the line?
No, actually, I recently, I think a couple of months ago, I went to go look onto my alma mater's website to see if they had been expanding their offering for what you can concentrate in as far as if you want a biochemistry or chemistry or toxicology. Mm-hmm. They've actually expanded to digital forensics.
Oh, that's cool.
And I actually asked some individuals, because there are a lot of programs now where you have a master's in digital forensics. So I asked on Twitter one day, I was like, does your program, do you actually have a lab set up to do digital forensics, or is it just all theory? So I think some programs are all theory. And from my little bit of research that I've done, I think a lot of the master's programs are a lot more theory versus the undergrad programs. They're doing a lot more practice on hands-on things. So I've seen a mixture of both, but I think that the more that you practice and get used to actually doing this, because you can theory your life away, but the better and more time that you practice doing the digital forensics, the better you will be and the better you'll understand what's going on out in the real world and not just a classroom perfect setting.
How'd you get involved and invested in DFIR in medical devices rather than the traditional DFIR?
So I'm in the healthcare field. So I work in toxicology, and toxicology is the area that I work in. I'm doing a lot of drug testing. So I find that we have several instruments, and every time for me, when I call in to get service on one of my instruments, they'll tell me, oh, you know, this is FDA cleared. This is classified as a medical device. And they have these questions that they have to ask me. Was anyone hurt while in the process of this incident? Were your patient results affected in any way? And do you want someone from the regulatory department to contact you? And normally the answers to those questions are no. And so anytime that they do anything to our instrument, anytime the field service engineers come in and do any checking and testing on our instrument, those reports are submitted into their database. And I'm pretty sure they have it where the FDA is also alerted of any changes that happen, software upgrades, part changes, anything. That's where I learned to say, hey, this is really something that's happening. And I need to make sure that I'm doing everything that I can to be preventative on my end, especially with patient results. A lot of our clientele is those who have drug habits, mm-hmm. and they're trying to get clean. So it really relies on that instrumentation part of it. And so I make every effort to make sure that I am clear on what needs to be done. I'm clear on what is happening on my instruments. And make sure it's fully functioning. So I take it very seriously in that respect.
So doing your due diligence.
Yes.
So you said that the technician is asking you questions about if any of the results were skewed and anything like that. How would you know? If you didn't have the background that you have, they're asking you a question that you cannot logically answer.
So in that event, I would tell, if I didn't know, I would tell them yes. Only because telling them no, and then you report out the wrong result is more detrimental than you telling them yes and having them actually come out and fix it and figure out what the problem is. Because if you tell them no, and it sends out, it kind of releases them from any fault or any accountability, right? They can say, well, you told us no, and your patient results weren't affected. So that's a user error and not a medical device error. So in that event, like I have a couple of colleagues that I work with, and they're not as experienced as I am. And I tell them, like, if we're running patients and you see something and you have to call, you tell them yes, because it's better to tell them yes and have it on the books to say, we made them aware of this issue, than to not tell them at all. And then something actually was wrong. Then you get into quality control incidents. You get into a lot of other stuff with licensing, because we're licensed by several states. So you can get your license revoked if you release the wrong results.
You know, one of the things that I hear pretty frequently is go and talk to doctors or to medical device makers or to hospital administrators. And they say, of course, cybersecurity is very important, but it's not like anybody's ever been hurt or anybody's ever died from a cybersecurity issue. And the quick and flippant answer that I usually give is, well, how would you know, right? Have you ever looked, number one? If you have looked, is there the chain of custody? Is there an evidence trail that will lead you to be able to actually know? And then is that reported out? Is it analyzed? Are there any clinical journals that are reporting on this? And, you know, so far, basically people seem to be making the claim that no one's ever been hurt from a cybersecurity incident. But there seems to be no real evidence either way. And so I wonder if you've had experience with that, where you know something's happened, or where you've tried to look at it and you've been unable to, because, you know, for instance, the device manufacturer says, you know, delete all the logs before you send it to us because we don't want any patient data, or things like that. What's been your experience in trying to figure out whether or not someone may have been harmed or killed from a medical device security issue?
So I haven't had much experience, but I always try to tell them, you know, you're right. They tell us delete all of the data, you know, the patient data, or I've had it where we've sent out, whenever the data is generated, they would like you to create a zip file of it. And there's an auto-generated PDF saying we won't use your, patient data that you've sent us because you have sample ID numbers on there, or you have case numbers on there. So the manufacturers get around it by doing that part of it. And then I haven't seen, I haven't seen that there's any, you know, a guideline or, a procedure on making note of this. And I don't know if they have analysts or hospital or scientists on the background looking at this data and collecting the data. I do my best to make sure that, you know, if there isn't an issue, we do correct it. Those are results. And the only thing that we can do is correct it, because when we give them results, we have facilities, and the nurses and the practitioners at the facilities are giving these patients medicine. So there are certain medicines that can't mix. So if we on our end have messed up, we need to immediately fix it. And because I've been doing this for so long and with working with specifically toxicology, I'm kind of very familiar with what drugs will interact or what drugs will show up together. Or, you know, if something looks kind of odd, my eye kind of catches it real quick, and I'm very cautious. And before I release a result, I'll say, hey, give them a call. Can we call the facility and have these people relay to us some additional information before I release this, because I don't want that on my conscience. I can't. That's something that I couldn't personally deal with. But I think that if there was like a standard, you know, repository or collection that, you know, hospitals and doctor's offices would kind of have someone, an analyst or something, looking at, you know, their instrumentation and their devices to see and notate what is going on, I think you can kind of, you will be able to see, okay, this type of device is always faulty when it gets to XYZ level. I think that if that was something that was widely accepted in the community to be monitoring, I think we would be a lot better, but it's not there yet. And I think using, telling them, you know, cybersecurity is important, but they're just, you know, lackadaisical about it. There's nothing sometimes we can do. Our hands are tied, but it always changes when something actually bad does happen. Then it's, let's put this plan in motion because XYZ has happened. But I don't like to be reactive. I like to be proactive.
Right. So in being proactive, and as a scientist, I would guess that one of the things that frustrates you is the lack of repeatability, the lack of clear evidence, the lack of, you know, scientific studies. So what would help you and help the scientific community, help the medical community, to be able to actually trace these things down and understand if there has been an issue, and if there has been an issue, whether it's been a cybersecurity related issue or, you know, truly a person issue where they input the wrong values or where they contaminated the samples, or, you know, what would help you as a scientist distinguish one type of error from a different type of error?
I think if there was like a public forum where everyone could contribute to, like, nothing where you have to be a member of the organization in order to comment on the forum. Because that happens too. You can't, if you're not a member of certain organizations, you can't comment on those forums. I think if there was a general forum for like each of the medical devices, right? And I think that if, you know, anyone that uses them, that, you know, the scientist that may use them, the biomedical engineer that may fix them, because sometimes those are the people that fix them. Sometimes you don't have, sometimes some organizations have separate people that use them and fix them. And then there are some organizations that have the same person that use them and fix them. I think that if there was a, you know, a public forum for each, I don't know, medical device, and you relay your issues, I think that that would help figure out and nail down as we're doing our testings. A lot of us use the same references. A lot of us use the same journal articles. A lot of us have the same methods on our instrumentation. So I think that if there was a forum, let's say for, you know, XYZ vendor saying, hey, reporting your issues here, so, you know, we can talk about it. And that will in turn help the vendors improve their instrumentation. And it's saying, especially if it's like they want improved user functionality, something simple, you know, that lets them know that you're working for your customers and you're working to make sure that your customers, which are your laboratory scientists, your doctor's offices, your hospitals, things of that nature, are doing medically sound work. Otherwise, because, you know, there's certain people that know certain information, it's not shared. You know, sharing the information will save somebody in the long run. And I think that the more that you share, the quicker you can come to a solution. So I think that if there was a public forum with all the medical devices that you can just list and people are relaying their issues, I think that, and everyone can read it, I think that that would be good for all of the communities, and then the medical device community and the cybersecurity community can see what's going on and try to work with these manufacturers to say, hey, this is how you can fix this so you don't have this issue.
I'm just thinking out loud right now in front of, you know, our hundreds of millions of subscribers to the podcast. But You know, I wonder if there's something that we could do this year at the CyberMed Summit that would be like a proof of concept to demonstrate the value of being able to capture and share that information, maybe in like a tabletop scenario or in some kind of a forensics simulation, so that we would be able to, in a more or less case study type of nature, be able to walk through the problem, the dependencies on addressing that problem, the failures in those dependencies or where those dependencies are missing, and then be able to show what better looks like. In other words, if we could set up a scenario where you've got your ultimate dream of whatever you need as a forensic scientist to be able to show harm or potential harm through these cases, if we could set up a demonstration of that or a walkthrough of that, then we could potentially help get good, well-founded information rather than just speculation out into the scientific community, the medical device community, so that they could then develop it more and act on it.
I concur. I think that's a good idea. The question is, will the scientific community and those manufacturers be okay with such exposure to having their instrument or their methodologies taken apart? But you can't improve if you don't have it torn apart and, you know, critiqued and saying where stuff can be improved.
I feel like we try to do this at the device lab at the Biohacking Village, primarily because some manufacturers have that issue of, I don't want my stuff put out in the open, whatever the situation is. But like Bo said, maybe this is something we want to bring in to the lab this year or as a demo or at the other conference, just so people can understand. And it's not about reputation as far as like we're trying to hurt you. It's about reputation of we heard the call. We understand we're trying to fix it.
I agree.
So I wanted to also talk about the talk that you gave this year at the Biohacking Village, because I think it was one of those like aha moments for a lot of people. So give a 1-minute brief on it.
So I basically wanted to talk about how forensic science and information security is very, 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 very much similar. Both industries have very varying disciplines. So you're not just saying, oh, you have to focus on ballistics, or oh, you just have to focus on defending, or ICS, or medical devices, or, you know, you have options. So that was one thing that people weren't aware of. They see, you know, CSI and think that it's just one thing, and it's really not. It's a multitude of things. So I wanted to make sure that people knew that these industries are very much alike. In addition, we have lots of regulations that forensic scientists have to follow, as well as the information security. You have the financial industry that have PCI DSS. You have us, where we have, you know, the College of American Pathology, also known as CAP. So we have very varying similarities, and regulation is one of them. Documentation is not as seen as heavily in InfoSec, but in science and forensics is very, very much important too. And I wanted to make sure that that is something that needs to be taken into consideration. And it may sound selfish of me, but I do a lot of my documentation because I think that I like a healthy work-life balance. So I think that that's one of my reasons for why I make sure the documentation is there, so that someone else can follow behind me and can get the exact same result, that reproducibility. And so I wanted people to realize that these two are very much alike, and I wish that they communicated a lot more and shared more information between the two, because I think that with healthcare being so far behind, because we do a lot of healthcare cases and deal with the public, I think that we could help each other. Both industries could help each other and talk amongst ourselves and between the two to figure out how we both can improve on both industries. There's always room for improvement. So that was my quick spiel on what my talk about at DEF CON was at the Biohacking Village.
I love it. And just as an FYI to the world, that's basically why I was like, hey, girl, hey, you want to come in and help? Because you have this eye for detail and finding all of the things. So you are in and you're helping us do the village this year. As a recap, I just want to put out there that the things that I took away from this conversation were time, tact, and technique are super important to everything in InfoSec and in digital forensics and incident response and chain of custody to tell that story in a mindful, meaningful way.
Correct.
All right. Thank you for being a guest on White Hats and Lab Coats podcast. We will see you next time. For more information, go to whitehatslabcoats.org.
Thanks for listening to the White Hats and Lab Coats podcast, presented by the Biohacking Village. Find us on iTunes, Google, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Join the community conversation and expand your gray matter on Twitter at @DC_BHV. And get transcripts, links, and show notes at whitehatslabcoats.org.